You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Thursday, July 27th, 2023, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Happy almost birthday, Steve.
Yeah, 2 days.
Yeah,
man.
My daughter's birthday is tomorrow.
Tuesday. Right, Julia.
Yeah, the day before I was on the calendar.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
It was, you know, we didn't know if she could have been born on my birthday. It was getting pretty close. Yeah, but she came out a day before. So it's good. So now we always do like the double header. Yeah, she always has her special day, but it is nice that, you know, it actually is convenient to have the double header birthday.
Definitely.
Yep. She's coming up this weekend. Looking forward to it. So Kara's not here.
Yeah, what happened?
Because there's a storm brewing. She's having some nasty weather in Florida, and her power's out. And there's simply no way. She still has her phone, so she's like texting me on her phone. And I just asked, is there any possible logistical way we could still do this with the power? Because I think, we could talk over the phone. You could just record off of your laptop on battery power. But the microphone doesn't work without power, so she has no microphone. So we're done.
So did you guys hear that the ocean temperature in Florida is bathtub hot?
Yep.
Like
over 100 degrees.
Over 100 Fahrenheit. Crazy.
That's got to be uncomfortable to go into.
Yeah.
Think about everything that lives in that ocean. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, but at what depth are we talking about? I could see a 5-foot depth being that hot, but once you get out into the deeper water, well, I guess it could still be the surface.
Colder water is heavier than hotter water, down to 4 degrees Celsius, right? So it's always going to get colder as you get deeper, and the water at the bottom of the ocean is going to be 4 degrees Celsius. But yeah, so they must be talking about this water, like the surface temperature.
Yeah, a buoy, I suppose, measures it, so that would be surface, right?
Kara's weather is going to be basically like torrential downpours for the next week. Jesus.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. She may join us later if she somehow gets her power back, but we can't count on it.
This is, and you know, the thing that scares me is this is just the beginning of the global warming effect. This is, we're not like 50 years into it, you know, it's going to get so much worse than it is now.
So there was a recent study out where the scientists are basically calculating what's the probability that we would be having the heat wave that we're experiencing now were it not for global warming, like the increase in the average global temperatures in the last 50 years. And it basically said it wouldn't be happening. Like it would be quote unquote virtually impossible without human induced climate change. So, and of course, you know, we've read sources that are saying, oh, it's not climate change, it's El Nino. Well, it's both, as I think said last week or the week before. It's, you know, there are two different things happening, and now we're getting both the peaks overlapping. So, yeah, it's warmer than average because of it's El Nino, but it wouldn't be this warm without global warming.
Yep.
That makes all the sense in the world, actually.
Man.
Yeah, I hate it when people do that. It's like, it's not A, it's B. It's everything, right? It's every factor that goes into it combined, and it makes no sense to pull out one factor as the cause.
Right.
I remember a funny example of that. We remember this, guys? No, you remember, Evan, because you hated this. We were coming home from Dragon Con, and we missed our plane.
Oh.
Yeah, it was me, Evan, and Bob. I think Jay was not there for some reason.
And it was only for one reason, right, Steve?
It was only for one reason. Of course, there was literally like about 12 different things, each of which made us a few minutes late. And of course there was the argument of, we're late because you had to go to the bathroom at the last minute. It's like, no, because Bob tried to get his dagger onto the plane and, you know, no, it was because they changed the gate on us at the last minute. We had to go to a different gate.
It was an awesome dagger.
Yeah. But it was, it was obviously the combination of factors that did
gosh.
It.
Yeah.
If it was true that any one of them were not present, we wouldn't have missed the plane because we'd literally closed the door 1 minute before we got to the gate.
And I remember, do you remember we actually walked by our new gate and didn't know it? And then we got to our old gate and they said, no, you got to go to your new gate.
Yeah, I know.
And we backtracked.
Comedy of errors.
But hey, it's good to have a scapegoat. So,
sorry, but, you know, missing an airplane like that, that is an intensely stressful situation.
Very stressful.
Oh my gosh.
Oh, then we were on standby. It was terrible. I only missed a plane one other time in my life. I was coming home from Chicago. I was by myself. And I left for the airport like 3 hours before my flight. Coming from the airport to the hotel was like a half an hour trip, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I said, all right, I'm going to leave 3 hours before my flight time. And we were in traffic the whole time. It was literally a 4-hour trip to the airport. And you know how, like, you're sitting in the car and time's going by and you're like, am I going to make it? I'm not going to make it. Like, it's a slow creeping lateness that's just painful. But fortunately, they literally just put me on the next flight like 30 minutes later. It turned out to be nothing. So, lucky. Yeah. It's like, whew.
That's the benefit of using a big airport.
Yeah.
They got lots
of Chicago. All right. I'm going to start off with a quickie. This is just a follow-up to my news item from a couple of weeks ago. Remember back 2 weeks ago when I was talking about Leqembi, that new monoclonal antibody Alzheimer's drug?
Yeah.
As the latest and greatest. Literally a week after I spoke about that news item, yet another one got approved by the FDA.
Oh.
There are now three drugs that are disease-modifying in Alzheimer's disease, meaning they're not just symptomatic. They actually change the course of the disease. They're all monoclonal antibodies. So there's Aduhelm or aducanumab, which got the accelerated approval in 2021, still being studied. And they have, and I think, another year to prove clinical efficacy and get their full approval. And then there was Leqembi, which is lecanemab, and that got full approval a couple of weeks ago, based upon clinical data showing a reduction in certain clinical measures of Alzheimer's disease by 27%. And now a large clinical trial shows that a third drug, donanemab, reduces Alzheimer's disease by 35%. This is interesting because these drugs are targeting amyloid, which is the protein that is abnormal in Alzheimer's, and they clump together and form the plaques and then is part of the progress of the disease. And, you know, we weren't really sure if they were just a marker of the disease or if it's really causing the disease. And this is the first time with these three drugs that we've closed the loop. And it's like, oh yeah, it's actually probably contributing to progression, because if you treat the amyloid, you know, if you bind to the amyloid, it actually reduces the progression of the disease. Now the Leqembi binds to the amyloid precursors, and the donanemab binds to the plaques themselves. So they have different targets. The advantage of the donanemab, the new one, is that if you treat patients for like a year, it takes away the plaques, the existing plaques, and then there are persistent benefits even after you stop taking the medication.
Whoa. I love when that happens.
But we don't know for how long. I mean, we'd have to follow up. You know, for longer. So anyway, couple of things to keep in mind. These drugs are all expensive. They all have side effects. Mm-hmm. Some of those side effects are severe, you know, bleeding in the brain and even death. Even, you know, there are some patients who die on the drug more than the placebo. And the clinical benefits, and I'm saying 27%, 35%, but that translates into a very modest benefit. You know what I mean? It's like, yeah, you'll maintain your function for a few more months, you know, than somebody who wasn't being treated. But just the mere fact that they do decrease clinical progression, again, I think that's a huger deal than the actual benefit, you know, that individual patients are going to get. Again, you know, Alzheimer's is a terrible disease. Any benefit is, you know, is a boon and is arguably worth it. But the benefit to just our understanding of Alzheimer's and going forward. So, of course, again, the hope is that this will lead to more better things, right? Maybe there'll be yet a third drug, maybe targeting another protein like tau or a different type of amyloid. And I don't know, maybe they need to add two or three of them together.
Yeah, a cocktail.
Get a cocktail going that starts to get to like really clinically significant decreases. Hopefully they'll be able to figure out ways to reduce the side effects, although I suspect it's kind of inherent to the mechanism of action, right? We're sort of binding to these proteins and targeting the immune system at them, and it's leading to inflammation. Of course it is, because we're targeting the immune system at them. It's that inflammation which is causing swelling and you know, predisposing to bleeding in some cases. So I don't know. It may be just part. It's like chemotherapy. It's like, yeah, you know, the side effects are part of the effect, you know, like you can't really get the effect without the side effects. It's kind of inherent to the mechanism of action. But it's basically a different world than it was, you know, before these three drugs came out. At least now we have this proof of concept that, okay, this does have the potential to really alter the disease. These three drugs, well, two of them have really been shown to be clinically effective. The Aduhelm hasn't really shown the clinical piece yet. And, you know, I mean, I know people who were like planning on going into a clinical trial, and now they're just going to get prescribed donanemab, you know, because it's available as a prescription now.
But you said it's expensive. So how does that work?
Insurance will cover it.
It will. Okay.
Yeah. The other thing is that they're really only indicated for early Alzheimer's disease. You know, if you're altering the slope, you know, it really only gets significant if you start really early.
Yeah.
You need that slope to separate out from the untreated group over a long period of time for it to become significant. And that's probably why, you know, basically for 30 years we've been trying to treat amyloid and it hasn't worked. And the researchers that are involved with these studies are saying, well, that's probably because we didn't go early enough or big enough, right? Now that we've done it with a big enough dose and early enough in the disease, that's why we're seeing some effectiveness. So I suspect insurance companies will be paying for it, but only if probably only for some criteria, like, you know, so, with early onset by some cutoff. The other thing, and then I think as I mentioned last time, is that the other way in which we could see this leading to really significant, clinically significant, not clinically modest treatments is if we combine it with early diagnosis. Imagine being treated 2 years before you would have been symptomatic based on some blood test or CSF test. That may be the world we're heading towards. You know, oh, you're at high risk, you have a family history or whatever. We do a blood test. Yeah, it looks like you got the type. We're going to start this treatment before you're even symptomatic, or maybe with like really like what we would call minimal cognitive impairment. You're not even really demented yet, but you have just an inkling that maybe it might be happening.
The drug that received the FDA approval a few weeks ago, once you're on it, you have to take it the rest of your life.
Yeah.
So is that also true with this?
No, the new one, it's like you take it for a year and you're good. You know, and they're thinking that maybe you just need some tune-ups, like every year you might need a couple more rounds or something.
Oh my gosh, that's such a difference between needing a drug for the rest of your life. And IV, right?
It's an IV infusion, yeah.
Yeah. How many other monoclonal antibody treatments are in the pipeline? Because
a ton.
The second one, you told me about it. I was like, wait, we just talked about it on the show.
Do you mean
like,
for Alzheimer's or just for anything?
Both.
Yeah. So there's a lot. There's a lot in the pipeline. There's a lot already out there. I mean, there has been a monoclonal antibody revolution in the last 5 to 10 years. I mean, monoclonal antibodies have been around since the 80s, 90s, you know, but we just got to this threshold where the technology was just viable. You know, it's like we got the humanized version so that they're good for, you know, large dose infusions. And, you know, we got monoclonal antibodies for everything now. A couple of years ago, you know, a whole slew of monoclonal antibodies for the prevention of migraine headaches came out.
Those are
the ones that I'm the most familiar with that I use because I'm a migraine specialist.
Steve, do you think that this might help anxiety and depression one day?
I mean, I don't think if you can make a drug to bind to a receptor, you can make a monoclonal antibody to bind to a receptor. You know what I mean? It's just a different way of acting on some therapeutic target. And, it's kind of a superior technology in certain ways because it's not really a chemical. So you don't really get the chemical side effects. Like you don't have to worry about liver and kidney and other kinds of side effects. It's a protein, you know, it's literally an antibody, but that causes other side effects. I think all things considered, you can make a reasonable argument that it's a superior technology to chemical drugs, but they're expensive. They're all really expensive.
Right.
Because they're biologics.
How does the price come down eventually on these?
Yeah, I mean, I guess that the hope is that with the technology, the technology will advance to the point where it gets cheaper and cheaper to mass produce them and, you know, economy of scale. But I mean, I don't think it's going to be cheap anytime soon. But you never know. Like there may be like the CRISPR of monoclonal antibodies will come out. Somebody figures out, oh God, we can make these orders of magnitude cheaper. You know, that could happen. Ooh. But for now, it's just like, okay, we have these really expensive, really awesome, you know, drugs. And we just have to use them wisely, you know, use them judiciously for people who really need them. You know?
Yeah, everyone's right. I mean, my gosh, there are going to be people who will want to take it sort of as a preemptive strike against it, even if they're not you know, otherwise a candidate to take these things. They're going to want it.
You won't get them unless you actually, you meet some criteria. Like for the Alzheimer's drugs, you need to have like the positive blood tests, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You need to make sure you have the target, you know, you have the plaque or the abnormal amyloid or whatever. So, but now more than anything, you know, one of the ways that like the practice of medicine has evolved over my career is that cost effectiveness is becoming more and more important. It was always important, but now it's like really the order in which we go through drugs is cheapest to most expensive. Like almost, you know what I mean? Like if you have a bunch of clinically, basically equivalent drugs in terms of the probability that they may work for a patient, we start with the cheapest ones and then go from there. Like that's the predominant feature now that in many contexts that guides our decision making. And for those people who don't like that, I also see the other thing. Like I've seen, like for getting back to migraines, that's what I have the most experience. I get referred patients who get started on these newer, more expensive drugs prematurely. It's like, really? You went right to the $7,000 a year drug and you didn't even try any of these other ones? And, you know, but they're by, you know, non-experts, and that's why they're getting referred to me. But that's one of the mistakes that they make. They just like go right to the new shiny, really expensive drug. It's like you should not do that. You're ruining it for the rest of us, because when they do that, then insurance companies clamp down. Then they make it harder for the patients who really need it to get the expensive drugs, because they you know, then they throw up all these barriers to prescribing them because they're being overprescribed, you know, as first and second line drugs when they really need to be third and fourth line drugs. So it's added a layer of complexity, you know, to the whole decision making process. Because if we don't make, as practitioners, if we don't prescribe in an economically responsible way, especially with now access to so many really expensive options, the bean counters are going to take it out of our hands, which they're already doing. But I mean, they'll make that worse. And this will either be like if you practice in a country with single payer, it'll be the government. You know, if you practice in the United States, it'll be the insurance company. It'll be somebody, but it'll be somebody other than the practitioner making that decision based upon economics, not on clinical concerns. You know what I mean?
All right, Steve, go ahead 50 or 100 years.
Yeah.
Where do you see monoclonal antibodies at like the peak?
Over the counter.
Their maturity. Like, what do you, like, I mean, besides the obvious, like, oh, there'll be fewer side effects and it'll be cheap. Is there anywhere else it can go to improve with better tech, even like sci-fi tech? What could we potentially see, you think?
Well, if we want to go to sci-fi tech, I mean, yeah, I think the progression will be we're going to get more and more applications. The technology is going to incrementally improve. The prices will come down somewhat. You know, we went over lots of technologies that could transform this. Imagine if you're essentially like 3D printing these things or whatever. You have some kind of a machine where it's like, okay, here's a drop of my blood. It not only makes your diagnosis, it personally crafts a monoclonal antibody for you and gives it to you. You know what I mean?
Wow.
Like yeah. Just, you know, just essentially like the equivalent. It wouldn't be like really a 3D printer, but I'm just saying like the equivalent of that where you're just bioprinting personalized drugs based upon your genetics, your disease, your protein, whatever it is, you know. Not just based upon a study of other people, and that could be on demand, personalized, you know, pharmacotherapy with monoclonal antibodies. That's totally plausible. All right, let's move on to some news items. That wasn't really much of a quickie, but Jay,
it's a not so quickie.
Yeah, can AI learn like humans?
Well, apparently not yet.
Oh,
But. But something, you know, some recent information has come out to shed some light on this. So when an AI system is trained, they use a method that's called continual learning. And this is a machine learning approach, you know, where a computer is trained to continuously learn a sequence of tasks over time. Now, the idea is to build on previously acquired knowledge, right? It's, you know, very similar to how humans do it. So, you know, you have old tasks that it performed, and as it learns the new tasks, it's supposed to get better at them because of this previous information of doing the older tasks. But one significant challenge is continual learning. In continual learning is something called catastrophic forgetting.
Uh-huh.
Now, this happens to me when my wife asks me to go to the store to get a list of items. Right? I mean, come on.
Yeah.
It's almost a mind blank. By the time I get to the store, I can't remember any of it. But in AI systems, catastrophic forgetting refers to the problem where an AI agent, you know, let's just say it's like, you know, one instance of an AI piece of software that's running, they tend to forget the information gained from previous tasks as they learn new ones. It is kind of similar to a way a person learning something new, but then they forget what they just learned before. You know, when I say similar, it's very different in the human mind versus what's going on in the computer, but the order of events and things like that, there is some similarities there. So this is a big problem because memory is crucial for AI systems, especially in applications like autonomous driving and robotics, because they need to have that catalog of information of previously learned, tasks, right? They need to have a ton of information at the ready at all times. Now, as these systems learn new things, it's essential for them to not forget the lessons they've already learned because, all that training data makes them safe and effective. And without that training data, you know, there and in the right shape in order for it to access it correctly, you know, we're never going to have an autonomous vehicle without that working perfectly. So overcoming catastrophic forgetting is vital to creating more robust and reliable AI systems in the future that can adapt and learn from these various past experiences. So this is a big marker here because, you know, I'm sure that the engineers are going to be able to figure out how to fix this and augment it and make this work, you know, make this system work much better and solve it. But right now, it is a legitimate problem. The research that's been conducted by the electrical engineers at The Ohio State University aimed to bridge the gap between how machines and humans learn. So by understanding how neural networks perform better when faced with diverse tasks instead of similar ones, the researchers found parallels with how humans recall information more effectively in different situations. So this insight can lead to improved learning algorithms that can mimic human learning capabilities. Now, again, when I say mimic human learning capabilities, you know, we're not talking apples to apples here because it's two completely different ways of working and everything. It's just like the big brushstroke ideas of what's going on in the human brain. And, you know, you transferred these ideas over to an AI algorithm that's learning. Okay. So like, you know, I'm not drawing a one-to-one comparison here. So to enhance the memory retention of AI algorithms during continual learning, the researchers suggest that dissimilar tasks should be taught early in the learning process. So very early on when they're training an AI system, they're recommending that instead of having like it learning 10,000 tasks that are almost identical, spread it out into lots of different tasks that don't have a lot to do with each other. And they said by doing this, the network's capacity for new information increases and it becomes better equipped to learn more similar tasks later on after that foundation has been put in. So this optimization could potentially lead to AI systems that can retain knowledge and adapt more efficiently to new challenges, which is exactly what we want them to do. So being able to have dynamic lifelong learning in AI systems, you know, it's going to be a big hurdle for the software engineers to figure it out. But of course, it's an incredibly highly valuable thing that we want to achieve. So I'm sure that tons and tons of money and resources will be put into solving this problem. You know, and having these advanced learning capabilities are going to allow machine learning algorithms to scale up faster, you know, handle more evolving environments and unexpected situations more effectively. You know, this very much sounds like, you know, autonomous cars, by the way. The goal here is to create intelligent machines that can learn, adapt, and retain knowledge in a manner similar to humans, right? But not exact, but similar, enabling a new era of AI with enhanced capabilities. So overall here, when I think about all this information, I think, you know, there's probably lots of things like this that they're going to need to improve in artificial intelligence to get it up to those next levels where it's really going to start to integrate into human society more and more. Like right now, you know, we have very powerful AI out there. It's, you know, there's a lot more artificial intelligence programs running in and around you that you don't even know about, right, Bob? You said, you know, your iPhone has multiple AI programs running on it that are doing things, and social media has artificial intelligence, but it is proliferating like crazy. But when we get past some of these hurdles that we're dealing with right now, it's going to make the explosion of AI even that more profound. And this is a big one, this memory issue that they've come up with. And you know, some questions that I couldn't find answers to is, how pervasive is it? Is this happening in every AI system, like every one of them? Or is it only happening in certain ones that are doing certain types of calculations or things? You know, it gets very complicated very quickly. But bottom line is, you know, there's a lot of unanswered questions here because we're not all insiders on the AI industry and exactly what's going on in all these, you know, thousands of different pieces of software that are out there right now. But I would imagine that this is a common problem by the way that they're reporting it. And, you know, I do hope that they solve it soon, even though I admit I am slightly intimidated by artificial intelligence at this point because of all the things I've been learning about it.
Well, there are plenty of people who are saying, you know, people who know a lot more about this stuff, Jay, and they're concerned.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think that's fair enough reason to have some concerns about it. And, you know, it would be more disturbing if we had fewer or no concern about it.
Yeah, I think my biggest concern about AI is the social impact of it, you know.
Sure.
Kara was supposed to talk about, I'll just give like a preview, she may talk about it next week, using AI to influence political campaigns.
Absolutely.
I think
matter of time.
It's the social media problem, but now times 100, because it's now AI is so easy to automate it. They found, there was another study, I'm not going to talk about this in detail, but there was another study that found that spam emails constructed by AI are more successful at fooling people and getting them to engage than ones that are made by humans, because the AI is able to personalize it more for each person. Imagine getting, you know, personalized, targeted spam. I mean, this already happens, but AI could just, again, it's like what email did to the chain letter, AI is going to do to social media and spam and all that kind of stuff. Is this going to be orders of magnitude worse?
Oh, gosh, I'm going to need AI to help me filter out the bad AI. Yeah,
totally. That's 100% true.
That's, yeah, absolutely.
Just like you need a virus protection to protect you against the viruses, we're going to need AI protection to protect us against the AIs.
Yeah.
You're not going to want to go out into the wild without your AI protector, for sure. And I just want to state officially, I welcome our AI overlords.
Stop. Listen, let me tell you something that's tangentially.
Let me tell you something.
It's a little bit connected to this. It's kind of like a little bit of mental health observation and thing that I've been doing recently. I decided a couple of months ago that I'm going to significantly limit my screen time.
Hear.
You know, like, I mean, man, working for the SGU, it's 100% screen time. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah, I know.
My work is as well, Jay. It's something I'm always cognizant of.
But I decided, you know, the thing that I have the most control over isn't really like how I do my day job. It's more about like the time I spend on my phone. I decided like at 7 o'clock, I'm going to really make it like a big deal to get on the phone. Like, I don't want to be on my phone after 7 p.m. And I absolutely refuse to pick it up in bed to read the news.
Mm-hmm.
I also notice the first thing I do is pick up my phone in the morning, you know, and I'm like, you know what? I want to get out of bed and do my whole morning shuffle without the phone being a part of it.
Yeah.
And I've been doing this for a couple of months, and I got to tell you that I really do feel like it's had a very, very healthy impact on my psyche.
Yeah, I think you need to balance your digital and analog existence. Absolutely. And, you know, for children, like pediatricians, their recommendation, they actually stopped recommending limiting screen time and shifting their strategy to maximizing play time. Like, get outside and play. Rather than saying you can only have this many hours of screen, that's less effective than saying you need to have this many hours of analog play, right? Or whatever that is, being outside or doing something physical and not just being engaged with digitally, you know, with the screen, right? So that I do think that works. You get outside, do some physical stuff, pick up a hobby that's analog, you know. And I do think there is a little bit of digital pushback.
You told me not too long ago, like, get outside and let the sunlight hit your face for 10 minutes.
Yeah.
Like, get that sunlight in your face in the morning to tell your body, you know, to wake up, because your body is very reactive to light. You know, your eyes seeing sunlight actually tells your brain to wake up.
Well, we live in a world of artificial light where we have the exact same light from getting up in the morning to go to bed at night, and we lose our circadian rhythm. So it's good to get sunlight during the day and dark at night. You know, yep. to try mm-hmm. to especially if you're having sleep problems, there's evidence to suggest that it causes visual problems. There's a lot more nearsightedness, which could be related to the lack of sunshine during the day. It's good for you to get outside, you know, if that's an option.
Yep.
All right, Bob, could this possibly be true? A room temperature ambient pressure superconductor? Come on.
Well. let's see.
Okay. Yeah,
viral superconductor news this week, creating a lot of buzz. I haven't seen this level of buzz.
A lot of
it doesn't
energy.
Happen that often. The name of the paper itself in the archive preprint server says it all. Just the name of the paper, which is unusual. And the name is The First Room Temperature Ambient Pressure Superconductor. That's it. That's the title right there. There it is. And it's so my response was like, well, wait, is this really one of the legit holy grails of science really happening now? Because it really is, one of the holy grails that I've been reading about for decades. So let's try to assess how excited we should all be about this, okay? Mm-hmm. Now, superconductors, we know what that is, right? I'm still going to tell you what it is.
Please.
It essentially allows electricity to flow perfectly, essentially, without resistance, and they expel magnetic fields. That's the 40,000 foot view of a superconductor. Those are the two most iconic characteristics. They're amazingly useful.
What about it? It has to be super cold, though.
Well, yeah, but that's just it. We only see them in niche applications like particle colliders or advanced medical imaging devices because it's expensive, it's bulky, and I'm sure it's annoying as hell to the people who actually deal with this all the time. To chill the components down to liquid hydrogen or liquid nitrogen levels. It's very hard, even though it was a huge advance to go from hydrogen to nitrogen because nitrogen is much cheaper. It's still, that's cold as hell, and it just requires a lot of stuff, money and bulk. Now, of course, there's been advances that have already been made, that there are already near room temperature superconductors out there, but they all invariably required ridiculous amounts of pressure to work. So it was like, oh, you're just trading off, you know, super cold with super, super pressure. So it's like, there's no real advantage there. So having a superconductor that is both room temperature and normal pressure at the same time, it would just revolutionize electronics and research in ways that we just can't even imagine yet. But even based on what we can imagine, it's clear that there would be dramatic repercussions to modern society. I mean, how could it be any other way when you're essentially making such a fundamental improvement to such a broad fundamental technology like electronics with, you know, things that use electrons? It would have to be dramatic to go to transition to such superconductors. Mohammad Yazdani Azrami of the University of Glasgow's James Watt School of Engineering said, "A real working room temperature superconductor, which works at ambient pressure, would be one of the holy grails of modern physics,
absolutely,
unlocking major new developments in energy, transportation, healthcare, and communication." So he agrees with me. He's a smart guy. And actually, no, I think I agree with him. So this latest advance boils down to something that's called LK99. That's it, LK99. It's a modified lead apatite, which is essentially a compound made of lead, copper, phosphorus, and oxygen. So they have to be mixed in powdered form in very precise ratios and then heated at high temperatures. And they can be made in just about 34 hours in a lab with basic equipment. That's it. And once this ingot is created, it's said to become a superconductor at 400K, which is 260 degrees Fahrenheit, 127 degrees Celsius. So based on their paper, I went through their paper, it seems to me that they looked pretty deeply at this substance, LK99, to confirm its superconductivity. It's not like they just said, electrical resistance is dropped and it's floating on a magnet, you know, the Meissner effect and stuff, and they're done. They actually use a lot of different tools. For example, they used X-ray diffraction. They looked at critical temperature. They looked at zero resistivity, critical current, critical magnetic field, and the Meissner effect. And then they analyzed that data using X-ray diffraction, X-ray photoelectron spectroscopy, electron paramagnetic resonance spectroscopy, and my favorite, a superconducting quantum interference device, also known as a SQUID. So they're really cool. So they use all of this technology to try to find out not only, you know, how it's happening, why it's happening. So the researchers say in their paper, all evidence and explanation lead that LK99 is the first room temperature and ambient pressure superconductor. The LK99 has many possibilities for various applications, such as magnet, motor, cable, a levitation train power cable, qubit for a quantum computer, terahertz antennas. And here's the kicker. This is like the last line of their paper. We believe that our new development will be a brand new historical event that opens up a new era for humankind. So yeah, bold claims for sure. But based on the two papers that have been released and looked over by other scientists, a lot of these scientists are not as convinced that these researchers are. For example, the best quotes I got were from Pablo Esquenazi. He's the head of the Division of Quantum Magnetism and Superconductivity at the University of Leipzig. So this guy, you know, knows he's in the biz, as they say. He said, "It's really frustrating. With such a title, I thought that it should be something serious, but it does not seem so.
Whoa.
The transport data on the manuscript cannot be taken seriously in the way they present it." And then at this point, Esquenazi references a video that's supposed to show that iconic hallmark of superconductivity, right? The material floating above a magnet, right? The Meissner effect, because that's because the superconductors expel magnetic fields. So if you put it on a magnet, it's going to push it away. So then that's why they flow, and that's why one of the iconic superconducting images. It's just such a potent image, and it became very popular probably in the 80s when they made the first breakthroughs with the higher temperature superconductors in the liquid nitrogen range. So he looked at that video. Now, this was supposedly the video. His source seemed good, but the video, we believe, was of this material, the LK99. So he looked at it, and so I saw the images, and this thing was only partly levitating. This was not fully levitating above the magnet. Only part of it was.
Yeah, like one edge of it was up and the other part was touching the material below it.
Right. So I'm like, what the hell is that?
Yeah, it's a hat.
So Esquenazi, regarding that specifically, Esquenazi continues and he said, "And about the levitation, well, I do not think that the video shows what we see when we have a superconducting material levitating on a permanent magnet. You can get a similar behavior with a sample having a part magnetically ordered near or on the permanent magnet. So in any case, it's really not worth discussing at this stage." So he thinks the papers are not convincing to him. He thinks it can be explained by other things potentially. And he thinks it's not even worth discussing, essentially, until, and in other quotes, he said, "This has got to be vetted." And that's obvious, you know, it's got to be peer reviewed and all that stuff first. It's not, and he doesn't even think we should be even talking about it until then, especially considering the papers. But there's also some weirdness going on with the papers themselves. Now, there's two papers. It's not one paper. There's two papers. One of them was the one that I mentioned, the one that specifically said first room temperature, ambient pressure, superconductor. That's the main paper. That's the one that went viral. That's the one that has three authors listed. There's three authors. But there was a second paper, had six authors, three of the originals and three others. So why, how come that has six? There's theories, weird theories of why that might be the case. But one of these extra authors is Hyun-Tak Kim. He's a research professor of physics. He said that the three-author paper was published without his knowledge and that the paper has many defects, as he says.
Oops.
He claims that a more up-to-date paper will be published in a peer-reviewed journal soon and that he supports any group that's trying to replicate their findings. And he specifically addressed the levitating, you know, the partially levitating superconductor. He said that it was not a pure sample in that demonstration. Okay, you know, do we give him the benefit of the doubt there? I don't know. But yeah, I'm a little excited about this for sure. Definitely I'm less excited than I was before researching it deeply. So I'm much less excited now than I was initially, now that I know some of the details. So as usual, peer review is going to be very telling. We're going to wait for the peer review. But who knows when that's going to be officially submitted. It could be weeks. It could be months, maybe. But on the other hand, I love that LK99 can be made quickly. There's no real nuance here on how to do this. The instructions are in the paper. You just need a simple lab, you know, with moderate skills. A lot of people are going to be making this.
Yeah, so we'll know soon if it's replicable, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, we'll know soon.
You could do it in a day and a half. They're saying 34 hours. Labs are absolutely already making it.
Bob, you may have to do a follow-up news item next week on this.
Oh, we absolutely. The guaranteed follow-up on this one. We may even have some feedback within days of this announcement. Today's Thursday, July 27th. We could have feedback tomorrow, Friday, or Saturday. Who knows? But I think we'll have feedback within days for sure. So, you know, if multiple labs over the next couple of weeks confirm the findings, that's going to be extremely encouraging, very, very encouraging. And my excitement will be ramped up significantly if they're saying, yeah, we made this stuff and it's superconducting. We get the full-on Meissner effect going on here. It's floating, you know, it's floating above a magnet and all these other tests we're doing. This looks really good. Or, and probably more likely, if I had to put some money down, I think they won't be able to reproduce the effects, unfortunately. I think that's probably more likely. Or there's going to be problems, or it's not a good superconductor, whatever. I think there's going to be issues potentially. That could happen as well. Neither of these would really dramatically surprise me. So as usual, we're going to have to wait, but I don't think we're going to have to wait too long to have a good feel for whether this is really dramatic or not. And one final thing I read on one website about this was that they think that this material, as described in the paper, cannot hold a lot of current, so that it probably won't be, even best case scenario, probably won't be ideal for like something like, you know, big ticket colliders or really energetic machines and things like that. It might not be suited for that because it can't hold as much current. But I think what the researchers are hoping here, and it's reasonable, that once you found this class of materials and other scientists start jumping on and examining the different combinations and permutations of these materials and find out what it can really do. They may actually find even better superconductors, assuming that it is a superconductor. They may find ones that can hold a lot of current, and that would be more ideal for the real big, you know, the big glamorous projects.
Sure,
that would use superconductors.
So
who knows? Fingers are crossed. We'll see. It's kind of exciting to think about, you know, what this could mean for society, because it would be a dramatic change in many ways technologically. We'll see what happens. That's all I can say right now. And fingers and toes crossed on this one.
So, yeah, I mean, I have to agree that this is like the neutrinos going faster than light. It's like, okay, that would be fascinating. But just it's so amazing. We have to be skeptical of it until it's absolutely confirmed. But well, Bob, I'm a little surprised that one application you didn't mention was fusion reactors.
I know.
Went without saying.
Whatever, just fusion.
Seemed kind of, I didn't want to even go with near fusion.
Oppenheimer.
For like tokamak fusion reactors. You know, we're trying to create really, really, really powerful magnetic fields to contain the plasma to get to the temperature and pressure that we need to create sustainable fusion. And the trick is creating fusion with less energy than the energy you get out of the fusion itself. And a lot of that comes down to the efficiency of the magnets. So having powerful superconducting magnets that you don't have to supercool with, you know, hydrogen or nitrogen is huge. That makes fusion way more plausible.
They'll be designing new reactors. If this is true, they'll absolutely be designing a whole new fusion test beds using this tech.
Bob, what's your bet? If you had to bet right now, is this real or fake?
I'd say it's fake.
Yeah.
I'd say it's not. Something's out of whack here. They couldn't convince a lot of scientists who read the paper who know their shit are like, they're still skeptical. And, you know, they have a reason to be skeptical, not only because it's just good science, but also there's been lots of crazy stuff going on with superconductor research, even lately.
Yeah.
People being, you know, having papers retracted, being accused of data manipulation and data creation, you know, and basically fraud. The skeptical hackles are up even more than typically with superconducting research. And that's part of the reason why they're so skeptical.
Yeah. All right, Bob, I'm actually a little surprised you didn't try to pick up this news item.
This came
out right after after the show last week. A galaxy without dark matter. So, which is not a new news, meaning we have seen these before, but this is it's still interesting. So you guys remember what dark matter is, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What is it, Jay? What's dark matter?
It's matter that we know is there because of physics, because it's having an effect on the universe and the way that galaxies move and everything. We know that there's matter there, but our ability to like really detect it and understand it is dubious.
So do you know the name of the guy who coined the term dark matter?
Yeah, it was Frankie Jismore.
Close. Fritz Zwicky. There it is.
Oh, that's his cousin.
Yeah, Fritz Zwicky in 1933 as one of the possible explanations for the rotation of the Coma Galaxy Cluster. Yeah. It's a galaxy cluster. But it really was locked down by Vera Rubin in the 1970s.
Yes.
And she was studying the rotation curves of galaxies. She's like, why are these rotation curves flat? They're spinning too fast, you know, and the stars should be flying away. That means there's more gravity holding those stars together than we can account for by the stuff that we could see, by the luminous stuff. There must be dark stuff there. And then she sort of resurrected the Fritz Zwicky's idea of dark matter to explain that. And it was a perfectly workable solution. But, you know, there's an alternative to the notion of dark matter.
Mond.
Yeah, the modified Newtonian dynamics. The alternative hypothesis is like, well, maybe it's not that there's stuff we can't see. Maybe Newtonian gravity works differently at really large scales, which is not a crazy idea, right?
I mean, totally crazy, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, it's in the same way classical physics is just a local manifestation of relativity, right?
Low mass, low velocity.
Yeah, the equations that account for high mass, high velocity physics essentially approach the classical physical equations at low mass, low velocity, like the frame of reference we are on Earth. The difference becomes indistinguishable. It took, the orbit of Mercury around the sun, where our ability to observe precisely was able to detect relativistic effects. In any case, so it's possible, like, or at the level of galaxies and superclusters, maybe there's this tweak in the equations that don't matter when we're sending probes to Pluto, but they do matter in explaining the rotation of galaxies. And that could explain the quote-unquote extra gravity. So how do we know the difference between the two? So one way is to see if there are any observations of things happening out there in the universe that can be explained if this extra gravity is being produced by stuff rather than being just an equation, a tweak to the equation. If it's a tweak to the equation, then it has to be everywhere, right?
Universal.
It's universal.
Right.
But if it's stuff, if it's dark matter, it could be, the dark matter could be absent in certain locations. It could be someplace and not another place. So I'm sure you remember one of the first, you know, dramatic examples of this. That's the bullet cluster, right? So you have...
Yeah, classic.
So the bullet cluster is actually two colliding clusters of galaxies, right? Now, when these galaxy clusters collide, the stars just pass through each other, right? Because they're so empty, you know, that the probability of two stars hitting each other directly is really remote. So even if it happens a couple of times, basically the stars just move past each other. But the gas clouds in the galaxies and in the galaxy clusters have pressure. So when they hit each other, they slow way down, right? So you have... You know, with this collision, you have the gas clouds in the middle because they slowed down when they hit each other, and the stars, you know, separated away from the gas because they just went right through.
Like a filtration process almost.
Here's the question. If the galaxy clusters are made of gas, stars, and dark matter, what would the dark matter do? Mm-hmm. Now, if the dark matter... If you know what we think, that it's something that really just has gravity but otherwise doesn't really interact with stuff and is dark, right? So the dark matter should have also just passed right through the collision. Yeah. But what do you think has more mass, the gas or the stars?
Oh, wow.
Probably the gas.
It's the gas. That's way more mass than the stars, right? So most of the mass of this colliding galaxy clusters be in the middle with the gas clouds. Most of the gravity should be in the middle with the gas clouds. So we looked at it with micro lensing or with lensing, and we sort of imaged the gravity of the bullet cluster, and there was more gravity with the stars than there should have been, just as if the dark matter was moving with the stars and not the clouds. Gas, which is what we would expect. So basically, we separated the gravity from the visible matter in the bullet cluster. That certainly makes it look like there's dark matter and not just its modified Newtonian gravity, right? Now, oftentimes I see this presented as this is like the definitive proof of dark matter. It's QED. Although the Mond people say, well... not so fast, that there's no reason why the equation changes in the modified Newtonian dynamics. They could be arranged in such a way that these extra gravity waves aren't, you know, with the visible matter in so they could basically replicate the bullet cluster if they tweak the equations the right way. Like, okay, I guess that's technically correct, but man, does that sound like a lot of special pleading to me.
Special pleading, yeah.
Yeah, that's like, oh, they're modified in just the way to make it look like it's dark matter. I don't buy it. I don't buy it at all. Okay, so here we are. Now we have another piece of evidence, and this has to do with relic galaxies. Bob, you ever heard of a relic galaxy?
I'm not sure.
This is relic galaxy NGC 1277. What's a relic galaxy?
Oh, it hasn't interacted in a really long time.
Exactly. It's basically a galaxy that has not interacted with other galaxies or other mass over the majority of its lifetime. Yeah. So it looks like it did in the ancient universe, right?
It's pristine.
It retains its ancient structure.
Neat.
In this case, the NGC 1277 is a relic galaxy, and it's also a massive really massive relic galaxies, three times the mass of the Milky Way. So the recently astronomers published a spectrographic analysis out to 20,000 light-year radius of this galaxy, of this relic galaxy. And what did they find? They basically found that it contains less than 5% of the dark matter that is predicted, that a typical galaxy would possess. Now they say less than 5% because that's the error bars, but they said the data is compatible with there being zero dark matter. Yeah. So basically it has zero
space over there.
Yeah, it basically has zero dark matter, but they said that, you know, with the error bar bars, we could say it's less than 5%, right? Okay. Now, that galaxy should contain between 15 and 60% dark matter by gravity, right? So where did all the dark matter go? So the authors hypothesize that either it formed without dark matter for some reason, or early on, the proto-galaxy components lost their dark matter, you know, so that when it came together as a galaxy, it didn't have any dark matter. So this reminds me of the bullet cluster, because now we have, because of some quirky thing about how the galaxy formed, again, it could be an extremely rare event because the universe is a really big place and we're going to see really rare stuff if we look in enough places, right? So it certainly looks like, again, another nail in the coffin of Mond, because if Mond is, you know, if it's modified Newtonian dynamics, it has to be universal. But if the extra gravity is stuff, the stuff could be not there because of some interaction, you know, that happened early on in the life of the galaxy. So again, the Mond people are not giving up, like, but still you could make the equations work. It's like, okay, but stop. You know, I mean, it's just not... whatever. I don't find, you know, as an amateur who's just trying to wrap my head around this, I go with the majority of astronomers who are like, dark matter is the simpler explanation. You really have to special plead the equations to keep Mond alive. But if we're talking about predictions, you know, I think that this observation, like the bullet cluster, aligns with the predictions of dark matter better than the predictions of Mond. So we can't say we've absolutely proven that Mond is false, but I think Occam's razor is massively in favor of dark matter as the explanation for the bullet cluster and now this relic galaxy without dark matter. But it's, you know, it's what this is, a one of those fascinating science stories. It's fascinating to watch how it plays out, how the two sides argue, and how they use evidence and prediction and the scientific method. And also, you know, again, because we're skeptics, you know, we get accused a lot of like, oh, you're always supporting the status quo and you're against actually skepticism and minority opinions of things. It's not true. Perfectly happy that there are Mond proponents out there forcing the majority of astronomers to defend, you know, the existence of dark matter. You know what I mean? It just it's likely to strengthen the consensus. And, you know, occasionally these fringe minority opinions may turn out to be true. And so it's good to have some people keeping the flame alive in case it turns out to be true. And I do think it helps the science and it helps actually strengthen the majority opinion to have to defend itself, you know, and to do the due diligence that they should be doing and not to get lazy and say, okay, we know this is the explanation. Let's not think about it anymore. It's all healthy. It's all good for science. It doesn't mean that the fringe minority opinions are likely to be true, right? It's not a reason to believe in them. It's just, it's like, fine, keep pushing Mond and we'll let the chips fall where they may. But I would say right now it's looking really good for dark matter. I don't think that this is going to be really fully resolved until we figure out what the hell dark matter is. Until we do need to keep a little question mark next to it. There's something there we can't see. We'll just call it dark matter. But it would be nice to, at some point, finally be able to say what dark matter is. Right now, we don't know. We have ideas, you know, machos and wimps, but we don't know. All right, everybody, we're going to take a quick break from the show to talk about our sponsor this week, Delete Me.
Guys, data privacy is a growing concern as we all have our private information totally exposed online. So did you know that there are hundreds of companies out there collecting your private information every day? They're buying and selling your information to basically whoever will pay for it. Identity theft and phishing scams continue to become more sophisticated as time goes on. So as we move forward, it's even more important to protect your personal data.
Delete Me is a hands-free subscription service that will remove your personal information that's being sold online. Once you've completed your sign-up for Delete Me, they will send you a welcome email so you can get started right away. You then log in and find your Delete Me personal profile page and tell them exactly what information you want deleted. Delete Me team of privacy experts take it from there.
To get all the benefits of Delete Me's data privacy and removal service, take advantage of the SGU's special offer. Go to joindeleteme.com/skeptic, S-K-E-P-T-I-C. This will give you 20% off for all consumer plans. Again, go to joindeleteme.com/skeptic.
All right, guys, let's get back to the show. All right, Evan, I always like it when people get convicted for fraud and pseudoscience.
Right? Yeah, I mean, even if it comes a little late, but hey, justice is justice. And yeah, we received an email a few days ago with a one-word subject line. It read, "Finally," with about 10 exclamation points behind it. So thank you, SGU listener named Christos, for your appropriately titled email. And yes, finally, some people are being held accountable for selling bleach in the guise of a faith-infused miracle health remedy. A federal jury convicted a father and his three sons of selling a toxic bleach solution as a miracle medical cure out of a fake church's website. And there were thousands of consumers all across the country and even more across the world. So this is the family behind the Genesis 2 Church of Health and Healing out of Florida. And I know I've talked about them at least twice before on the show. Jay, I think you've talked, you've done a report at least on once on them. And I think Kara might have even touched on them before. Miracle Mineral Solution. Do you guys remember that? MMS? So
yes,
this was, yeah, this was reported at the Miami Herald. Jay Weaver was the author of this news item. Jay Weaver is the author of the news report. And he reminds us that the Genesis 2 Church of Health and Healing had sold tens of thousands of MMS orders in violation of federal law since 2010. It was in that year that Mark Grenon claims to have founded the organization with a man named Jim Humble, whom I've spoken about before, in a plan to avoid governmental regulation and arrest as they promoted MMS as a miracle cure. Humble, a man who has dabbled in Scientology and professed to be a 1-billion-year-old god, began promoting the substance as early as 2006 in self-published works after he claimed to have discovered its medical properties while on a gold mining expedition in South America. After Humble supposedly stepped away from the organization in 2017, Grenon continued to manufacture, promote, and sell MMS with his three sons. I'll give a slight correction or addition for Jay Weaver here. Yes, a billion-year-old god he professed to be, but also who is from the Andromeda galaxy specifically. MMS, what is it? What is this stuff? It's 28% sodium chloride in distilled water. That's the equivalent to industrial-strength bleach. Proponents of MMS recommend diluting it in either water or food acid, such as lemon juice, which results in the formation of chlorine dioxide. Now, chlorine dioxide is often used to do things like sterilize medical equipment, laboratory equipment, surfaces, rooms, and tools. Not to mention, it's used in the electronics industry to clean circuit boards. And it's also used to bleach paper and textiles in those manufacturing processes. Yeah. So Jim Humble, who I mentioned before, who is the co-founder of this cult, he's a fellow who calls diseases like diabetes fake and made up, among many other things. But he claims MMS could be used to successfully treat AIDS, hepatitis A, hepatitis B, hepatitis C, malaria, herpes, tuberculosis, most cancer, and many other ailments. And so he says that 5 million people around the world have used MMS. Hundreds of thousands of lives have been saved as a result. I could go on a lot more about all the sickness that actually people have gone under in taking in this substance, you know, including vomiting, nausea, diarrhea. And
it's bleach.
It's bleach.
It's industrial bleach.
Yes. Yes. But you see, you getting sick, the purveyors of the MMS poison, they attribute the vomiting, the nausea, the diarrhea, and all the other effects from it. That means the product's working, you see. It's making it's actually making you better.
Getting your toxins out there. By the way, that kind of argument is centuries old.
I know.
That's the notion. That like whatever sign of like disease progression is actually a sign that whatever quack treatment they're giving you is quote unquote working. That has been going on for as long as there has been quackery.
Oh gosh, yeah, bloodletting is like, yeah.
They used to think that the pus coming out of a wound was a good thing, not a sign that it was horribly infected and you got
right.
Died,
yeah,
you
well,
know?
I have no idea what infection was. Right. Yeah. Okay, so the guilty parties: Mark Grenon, son, and his three sons, Jonathan, Joseph, and Jordan. Yep.
It only took Larry and Curly.
Yeah. Like the, wasn't there a show called My Three Sons? I think there was, but yeah, it has nothing absolutely to do with this. Yep. Found guilty. It only took the jury, it was a jury trial, 30 minutes to deliberate.
Nice.
To come up with the guilty charges. Guilty of conspiracy to defraud the U.S. government and the FDA, which obviously regulates the food and drug industry here in the United States, by distributing an unapproved and misbranded drug. That conviction carries up to 5 years in prison. So that's what they're all facing. Plus two of the Grennans, Jonathan and Gordon, also found guilty on counts of violating federal court orders requiring them to stop selling MMS back in 2020. Those counts carry a maximum penalty of life in prison. Mm-hmm. We'll see how that fares out for them. Oh, and it was specifically said that the Grennans could not use the First Amendment in their defense, in their trials, you know, the religious freedom clause that's in there. Because their so-called church is not a recognized religious entity. You can't just make up a church and say it's a church, and therefore everything we do is protected under the First Amendment of the Constitution. So, sorry, cults everywhere, your criminal actions are not protected by the U.S. Constitution, thank goodness.
But that's also – everything here is an old scam, right? That's the Scientology scam, right? That literally with L. Ron Hubbard did. He wanted to create an alternative to psychiatry, like snake oil thing. He got into trouble. He's like, well, if I make it a religion, then I'm good, right? So then Dianetics, just make it into a religion and you get beyond the problem of like the free speech thing and everything.
Right.
Yeah, using, you know, also using like this is protected speech when no, it's commercial speech, which means that you can't commit fraud. Fraud is not protected speech.
Thank goodness.
Yeah, but we keep having to fight the same thing over and over and over again, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And look, hey, it took, well, 2006 is when this started. Here we are, 2023, 17 years from the beginning of the, you know, of the crime, basically, to now. And finally, we're seeing these people brought to justice. So it does take a while, but, you know, at least we do in some cases finally see it, even though it's a long, hard slog to ultimately get there. They are appealing, obviously, this ruling, but I doubt this really has any standing at all to be turned over on appeal. So I think these people better get ready for the sentencing coming up in the coming months.
I've also dealt with these cases myself. Like, I've been asked to give expert testimony on behalf of like the prosecution or state health departments. And while it's great when they go after stuff like this, I do find that there's a lot of naivete.
Mm-hmm.
Like a lot of times, they just don't get how psychopathic these people are. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's like they want to give them a slap on the wrist. Like, how could we keep this person from abusing this? Like, you can't. This is what they do. There's no box you can put them in. You got to put them in freaking jail.
Yes.
Right? Or completely take away their license to practice medicine or whatever it is that they're doing. There's no good faith, you know, reasonable, you know, parameters you can put on them. Right? Otherwise, they wouldn't be doing this in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. And we see this also many times when psychics have to answer in court. You know, they're often found guilty for things like, you know, violating the, some financial or, you know, something about defrauding, but nothing specifically really about the fact that they don't really have these psychic powers, right? That they're absolutely lying to their people. No, it's because they violated this statute or that statute. So I get it. You have to get these people on technicalities. You know, it's the old Al Capone thing. You know, Al Capone didn't go to jail for, you know, ordering the murder of a bunch of people. He went to jail because he didn't pay his taxes. So, you know, you kind of have to work within whatever system there is, but you know, it's somewhat less satisfying in a sense to unfortunately not see these criminals, you know, brought to heel for exactly their nefarious actions. But you know, hey, any way you can get them,
I'm okay with it. All right, thanks, Evan. Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this very quiet noisy. So Sorry it was so quiet, but it's an interesting sound. I thought it was worth going through with you guys. So I got a lot of guesses, lots of different types of guesses, which is always interesting for me to see people like, you know, send in a huge different variety of different things. Here are some of the fun ones. So a listener named Richard Smith wrote in and said, to who's that noisy? Although it's not hitting in the back of my head like the sound of one I encountered years ago, I'm going to say that this week's noisy is the chattering of a bat. I thought that was such a cool guess. That is not correct. It is not a bat, but that was a fun guess. Another listener named William Steele wrote in. He said, to who's that noisy? Hi, Jay. I'll cut straight to it. I think this is Perseverance dropping a core sample on Mars. And then he links to it. So basically, Perseverance is taking samples of the Martian regolith, like digging holes into the surface, and then getting samples, putting them into sealed tubes, and then dropping those tubes onto the Martian surface. And we're supposed to send, you know, we talked about this
collectors,
on the show months
yeah,
ago.
We're going to go yeah. pick them up.
Whole collector so cool. system. Very cool. That is not Perseverance dropping core samples on Mars, but that is a very fun guess. Another listener named Dougal Morris wrote in and said, hi guys, I have a hunch that this week's noisy is a recording of the Titan sub imploding. If not the real recording, then a simulation perhaps. It is not that noise. And I'm kind of glad we don't have a recording of that actual noise. Mm. You probably wouldn't. You can't hear screaming.
I mean, well, it's terrible.
No, I mean, I think they're just talking about, like that's the when they were just recording like the sonogram yeah. or whatever, just that, whatever that anomaly was.
Yeah. But that wasn't it. God, that freaks me out when I think about it. Another listener named Michael Blaney wrote in and said, hi, Jay. Really odd. I'm going to guess it's really volume increased recording of a spider traversing its web. Oh, my God. I love that guess. What a cool sound that would potentially be. Now I need to know what that sounds like.
We just got to turn you into a fly. We'll use the pods.
So, guys, nobody guessed it.
Really?
And I'm not surprised. I'm not surprised because it was a very subtle noise. There wasn't a lot of detail. But this is actually the sound of water freezing and crystallizing. So it's essentially the sound of ice, of water freezing into ice in that moment when the ice forms very quickly over a very thin layer of water. So let's listen to it again. Yeah, I thought that was really cool. I think that's really cool. I like that sound. It sounds pretty much exactly what I would think it would sound like too, which is rare. It's very rare that I'm like, yep, that's exactly what I would think that would sound like. It has that ice sound. I don't know how to describe it. It just has an ice sound to it, which once you listen to it and you know what it is, you can visualize it. It's very cool. There's a video attached with this that I thought was really cool to watch. All right, guys, let's move on to a new noisy this week. We have a noisy that was sent in by a listener named Brian Perry, and here's the noise. I love this noisy because it could be so many different things, right?
Yep. Animal, mechanical. Could be.
Yeah, perfectly vague. It's in the sweet spot. Very fun. So if you think you know what this week's noisy is, or guys, you heard something cool, just take the minute. Send it to me. It makes a big difference because the quality of the show is dependent on you sending me good noisies. You can email me, and you should try to only email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve, we have things coming up.
Yeah, I know.
We will be at Dragon Con, as you guys know. And if you know, you already know when the dates are and all the details about that. So
Labor Day weekend.
Yes. But it's going to be a lot of fun. We're really looking forward to it. I haven't been there in a long time. So we'll see you there. We'll be on the Skeptic Track, and we have a few different panels that we're all doing. We will give you all those details probably over the next couple of weeks as we get the final info on when these things are going to be happening. The big thing we have coming up, though, and the thing that I am very proud of, is our new conference that's called Nauticon. It's called Nauticon because this isn't the kind of conference where you go and you listen to people talk all day. And let's face it, we've all been to science and particularly skeptical conferences. And, you know, you see a lot of the same faces, a lot of, you know, similar content. What we realized was a lot of our patrons and listeners were telling us how much they miss the in-person conferences, and it became very clear to us that they miss it because they miss interacting and socializing and actually just having fun. So what we came up with is a conference that revolves around having fun and socializing. There's going to be a lot of activities that we have planned throughout the day on both days. So this would be November 3rd and 4th. Actually, we will all be there on November 2nd at night, or at least most of us will be there prepping and hanging out and doing things. So if you are there that night, keep an eye out. You'll definitely see us there. We can all hang out, you know, on Thursday night as well. But on Friday and Saturday, we have two full days of programming. We'll have nighttime entertainment for both Friday and Saturday night. Right now, we are going to be doing Boomer versus Zoomer, which is our game show. We'll be pulling contestants out of the audience for that. And on Saturday night, we'll be doing Brian Wecht and George Robb's Insane 80s Sing-Along, which is going to be a ton of fun. And George likes to remind me to tell you guys to wear 80s clothing. That'd be great.
Still have plenty.
So those are the two nighttime activities. And then afterwards, there is plenty of time to stay in the hotel and go to the socializing places that I have selected, I have handpicked. This is a really fun conference. It's a great place to unwind. It's a great place and time to hang out with people from the SGU. And Andrea Jones-Roy, George Robb, and Brian Wecht will be joining the full cast for SGU. So please do join us. Go to the skepticsguide.org website, and you can see there's a button on there on the homepage that'll take you to all the information you need. Please do join us. It's going to be a lot of fun, and we're really looking forward to it. Now,
yes,
I have been asking SGU listeners over the past couple of months to please consider, if you do enjoy this show, if we educate you, if we entertain you, if you appreciate the work that we're doing, now is a wonderful time to become a patron of the show. You might notice that there has been a very low number of ads on the show. And as I've explained in the past, there just isn't a lot of ad companies that are buying ads right now. There's a big lull, and it would work very well for us if you are inclined to do so. Now would be a wonderful time to become a patron, because we could really, really use your support to keep doing what we do. And again, I'll remind you, we've been doing this for, Steve, how many freaking years have we been doing this?
18 years.
Almost two decades of 100% free content. Becoming a patron and showing your support is a very small thing you could do to show your appreciation for the work that we do. So please do consider doing that. We really can use your help right now more than ever. Go to patreon.com/skepticsguide for all the details. And we really, really appreciate those of you who have recently joined. Thank you.
Thank you, Jay. All right, we got one email. This email comes from Mitch. And Mitch writes, "My friend and I have been having an ongoing discussion for a long time about the role of talent in people's abilities, and I thought it would be interesting to hear all of your perspectives. The discussion is a lot to summarize, and I think talent itself is difficult to define. For example, my friend has mentioned several times that things like natural abilities or genetics are what give a person their talent. But to me, things like size, speed, and others are all trainable to some degree and also depend a lot on development. Like if you grow up food insecure, you probably aren't going to be as tall as you have the potential to be. My friend brings up the example of Michael Phelps and his out-of-the-ordinary body in terms of wingspan and lung capacity. I argued back that his lungs probably wouldn't have developed in such a way if he wasn't the athlete that he is. And while there are always going to be people far on the outside of the normal distribution of certain characteristics, that alone isn't going to be the reason they are successful at something." All right, you give us some more examples, but basically that's the discussion. What is the difference between talent and overall ability, skill, success? What do you guys see? You have any immediate thoughts on that?
It's complicated. Stuff. Yeah, and I agree with Evan that it's a combination. I mean, look, you know, we're all born with, you know, bonuses and deficits, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for example, my 10-year-old son is musically inclined. He absolutely is musically inclined. He can sing on key. He can identify notes very easily. This is not something that most people can do. He also picks up, you know, when he's playing a musical instrument, he's very comfortable immediately. But if he doesn't work on it, if he doesn't make it a priority, if he doesn't dedicate the time, and put in the incredible amount of work it takes to really, really become proficient in something. It doesn't matter how talented he is out of the box. He's just not going to get to where he, of course, you know, where he potentially could be. I think the 90%er is definitely the effort that you put in. But I will say something like this. So take Prince, for example. Prince, he out of the box, an unbelievably talented musician. That guy can play multiple instruments. Like on his first album, he played every single instrument, did every single thing. You know, this was clearly somebody that was born with a remarkable talent. Elton John is another example of a musician born with incredible talent. But they did work their asses off.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. And since they were, what, 4 years old, right? Very early on in life. And in a lot of these cases, you know, certainly when we talk about Olympic athletes and these sorts of people who train to become, you know, some of the best in their sport, they get to it right away and devote almost every free hour possible that they can to their craft.
Yeah, but, you know, I think it does to be a Michael Phelps. I do think you have to be born with something significant.
Well, sure. He's got, you know, he also has the physicality, you know, the physical features that has certain advantages that when he goes into the water, say, against someone like me, who's much stockier, shorter limbs, shorter body and everything else, you know, there's no way somebody with a build like mine could compete with someone with a physical build like his.
I would say, like, you know, to perform a mental test that you couldn't really do in real life. But you take 10,000 people and all of them try to do what Michael Phelps did, right? All the different types of bodies that they have and genetic predisposition and whatever, right? Michael Phelps is going to be the only guy that gets to that level. You know what I mean? Like, everybody can't do it. You could,
yeah, that's
you could,
that's the upper echelon of human performance. For the, and you said it, Jay, the vast majority of scenarios, it's going to come down to just your effort and dedication, regardless of the genes. Only when you really get to that upper echelon of performance, you know, approaching that wall of, you know, what is possible with human biomechanics, you know, that you see in sports and Olympics and world records is the best example. You can't beat a combination of dedication, hard work, and you know, genes that make you more prone, more able to perform a specific ability. Right. You can't beat that combination, but that only comes into play in the most rare of circumstances. For most scenarios, it's just about the effort, and don't worry about the damn genes.
I disagree. I wouldn't frame it that way. I wouldn't frame it that way exactly. I think the way to think about it is that your talent is really two things. One is, I think you could say the talent is just biologically what is your maximum potential, but also it's the ease with which or the rapidity with which you can develop a specific skill or ability. And there's evidence to back this up. For example, you know, there's the, you've heard like the, whatever it is, like the 10,000 hour thing. Mm-hmm. Like if you spend 10,000 hours doing anything, you can become an expert at it. But some people could get there in 5,000 hours. That's talent. Mm-hmm. It's putting in the 5 to 10,000 hours. That's your skill. But how many hours you need to put in to get to a certain level, that's talent. And when you're pushing up against the limits of human ability, like how far you could get to is also talent. So it's speed and the absolute limit. But yes, you need to put the work in to get there. But those two things factor together. And sometimes, Bob, you know, the talent thing can be extreme. Like you can go, some people can get to high levels of skill much more quickly than other people. The other thing is, you know, we have to focus on the other end too. It's not just at the high end of ability. It's a bell curve, right? It's at both ends. There are some people who are at the low end of that bell curve. They have very little talent, and it would take them 20,000 hours, and they would never get up to an expert level because it's just don't have the ability. They don't have the talent. So I don't think you could say it's one dominates over the other. I think it's really a combination of both.
Yeah, I mean, but still I think that for most situations.
Yeah, for most people, if you're in the middle of that bell curve, it's going to be all about your work.
And the thing that annoys me about this is that often people will say, oh, he's so talented.
Yeah.
And they just go right to the talent angle and they don't even mention or even think about, you know, that person has put in a tremendous amount of effort and time and dedication, and that's to be commended.
You're right, Bob. And you know what the perfect example of that is?
People don't say that or think it.
Any time a band, quote unquote, makes it, or a new band, they're not a new band. They are not a new band.
An overnight success.
An overnight success that took 10 years, right? Yeah, and that's with everything. Like, you can't – I truly believe that most people can find something that they have a predisposition to be good at, right?
I think there's something to that, Jay, right? Michael Phelps will never be a world-class jockey, for example. So you also have to have a certain recognition sort of where you where your abilities potentially lie. And you can't shoot for things that are going to be near impossible for you to reach physically or otherwise. So I think the people who rise to the top also recognize that and decide to focus their efforts towards something that they know is attainable.
And this is why, as a parent, it's a wonderful thing to help your children explore what their potential talents are.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
Right? You know, try all the different sports and music and take them horseback ride, whatever.
But, but we have to keep in mind there's 8 billion people on this planet. Mm. The chance of you being, you know, the best at anything better than 8 billion other people is really remote. Most of us have to be content with relative mediocrity. Yeah. And it's fine. Because the thing is, with the hard work, with your 10,000 hours, you can get into the top 5%, the top 1%, because very few people are going to put in that much work. But if you want to win an Olympic gold medal, you know, then you're talking, you need that combination of talent and work, because you're trying to outcompete 8 billion people, right? Basically, you know, it's so extreme, you know, that you have to be functioning at such a high level. But, and we get this a lot as well in the intellectual arena. And I think it's easier there to just say, oh, that person's just really smart, you know, because it's also
makes you feel better.
Playing the talent card, like, It is such a disservice to the hard week that work that people put in. It also is a get out of jail free card. It's like permission to be mediocre, because you're like, well, I don't have the talent, so I can't be blamed for not being good at this. But even something that seems like just raw talent takes a lot of work, you know? Like, people ask me how do you do all the work that you do and everything? It's like, it's because I've been doing this for 30 years.
Dedicating yourself, your life to this.
Gee. Yeah.
Hey,
I do it all the time. I work at it really hard.
I picked up bread making, right?
Expertise.
Yeah.
To a casual observer, all of a sudden I was making a good loaf of bread. But, you know, my process was meticulous. You know, like, I went through a lot of recipes. I read books. I watched tons of YouTube videos. I talked to people. You know, it was my number one hobby for a long. It still is my number one hobby, but, you know, and I watched myself go through this process of learning how to do it. It took a lot of time, and I really sucked. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And now you're good, but if you wanted to be world class, it would take years.
Yeah, it would take years.
Definitely. Perfecting it.
And that's true, Jay. In anything.
Jay's Bakery. That sounds good.
Guys. The question is, are you ever going to get good at science or fiction? That's the real question.
Nah. So, no, I'm getting worse as the years go by statistically.
Well, the problem is I'm getting better too.
Yeah. All right, but I know.
Let's go on.
It. It's like an unlevel playing field.
Let's go on with this week's science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items or facts, 2 real and 1 fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. 3 regular science news items this week. None of them are about room temperature superconductors. That would have been a great science review.
I don't know.
If you didn't have it.
Yep.
If I saw that first.
That news item.
All right, here we go. Item number one. Scientists have been able to reanimate nematodes taken from Siberian permafrost that were frozen for 46,000 years. Item number two. New research finds that despite diverging evolutionarily 179 million years ago, the honeycomb design of honeybee and paper wasp nests derives from a common ancestor. And item number three, researchers were able to transplant mitochondria into damaged kidney cells, improving energy production and reducing toxicity and physiological stress. Evan, go first.
All right. First one about scientists. They've been able to reanimate nematodes, huh? Taken from Siberian permafrost. And they were frozen for 46,000 years. Nematodes. Steve, could you please remind the audience and me of what a nematode is?
They look like worms. Does that help you?
Ah, wormish. Okay.
Very helpful in genetic studies and fascinating and ubiquitous.
Now, okay, so the definition of reanimate is clinically dead and then...
Well, they were frozen.
Ah, okay.
And now they're alive.
Well, is frozen death? I mean, I'm trying to... Maybe the clue here is the word reanimate. Other than the movie Reanimator, what's my definition of reanimate?
They start moving again, I guess. I
guess I'm not going to get any further help on that one. That's interesting. Second one about diverging evolutionary... despite diverging evolutionarily... 179 million years ago, honeycomb design of a honeybee and paper wasp nests derives from a common ancestor. Okay, so they diverged 179 million years ago, but the honeycomb design itself...
So it goes back all the way to 179 million years.
Okay.
To their common ancestor.
I have a feeling
ancestor.
That one's going to be right. That sounds... neat. That's a long time. I mean, you know, 179 million. I mean, oh boy, you are talking a significant amount of time there. But yeah, I have a feeling that one's right. Now, this last one is probably the one that I maybe understand, maybe the least. Research is able to transplant mitochondria, okay, into damaged kidney cells, improving energy production and reducing toxicity and physiological stress. Able to transplant mitochondria into damaged kidney cells. We don't know.
So you know what mitochondria
is? Yeah, mitochondria is the center of the cells.
No, it's the nucleus.
Energy production.
Mitochondria are organelles that are the energy. So they produce energy for cells.
Okay, but into damaged kidney cells, which we don't know which animal we're talking about, first of all. So I think, you know, that's hard, right? I mean, that's... transplanting mitochondria? I don't know. Has that happened before? Is that technology that... I don't know about that. It seems improving energy. I can see how it would improve energy production. Sure, if you could transplant it in there. And it sounds very specific. But I don't know if that technology really is available. All right, I guess I'll go with that one. The damaged kidney cells one is the fiction.
Okay, Bob.
These are good. I hope the mitochondria one is real and the nematode one, 46,000 years. I mean, we've like had desiccated, I've read estimates that a desiccated, what was it? Bugbear?
Bugbear.
Water bears.
Oh, water bears.
Yeah. I know I've heard estimates of 100 years for them of being like desiccated, then just add water and bloop, I'm good. But 46,000. Damn, I might have just talked myself into this one. 46,000. I was going to actually go for the most reasonable one, which is the B one, and just say do a little meta Costanza kind of guessing and say that's got to be the one that's fiction. But 46,000 years, I'll say that one's fiction. It seems way too long.
Okay, and Jay.
All right, the first one about the nematodes, I believe it. There was probably some circumstance, how they were frozen or whatever, where they were
46 millennia.
Yeah, that's a long time. I know. Stranger things have happened. The second one, 179 million years ago, the honeycomb design of honeybees and paper wasp nests derives from a common ancestor. So the honeycomb design and the wasp nest, I mean, they don't look like anything like each other. I mean, but, you know, I guess maybe, you know, maybe that where they put the larva is a little similar. There is some similarity there. I'm not sure. That's an interesting one. I wouldn't be surprised that they have a common ancestor either. And then the last one here, transplant mitochondria into damaged kidney cells and improving energy production and reducing toxicity. That one, for some reason, strikes me as science. I don't know. I'm going to say that the honeycomb one is a fiction.
Oh, interesting.
Oh, boy. We're all spread out.
Kara, nice. Where are you?
Steve can't sweep.
Break the tie.
Okay.
In order?
So I guess I'll take these in order. Scientists have been able to reanimate nematodes taken from Siberian permafrost that were frozen for 46,000 years. Bob, you think this one is the fiction. Evan and Jay think this one is science. And this one is science.
Ah, 46,000 years.
46,000 years.
Now, does reanimate mean they just put an electric charge into it and get it to jump around?
No. They just warm it up. It was frozen. They just defrost it.
Thought it.
And they rehydrate it. They rehydrate it.
Oh, so Bob was on the right track there with that suggestion.
So, yeah, wow, called man. Cryptobiosis. Cryptobiosis is when these organisms like water bears or bugs, nematodes go into suspended metabolism. They have evolved a combination of genetic and biochemical pathways that enable them to survive for prolonged periods of time. But this is the longest that they've been able to reanimate something by like an order of magnitude, right? They went from thousands of years to 46,000 years. So that's surprising.
Wow.
But I guess once you're desiccated and frozen, I mean,
I guess
you know, you're like the thing, right? How long you're telling me that this mofo crawled out of the ice after a million years? Yes, that's what we're saying. This nematode crawled out of the ice after 46,000 years and was still ready to go. So also, I mean, it's like it's so old. How old is it? It actually belongs to a new species, you know, that they hadn't identified before. You know, one that was alive 46,000 years ago. Hmm. Yeah, very, very cool. All right, let's go on to number two. New research finds that despite diverging evolutionarily 179 million years ago, the honeycomb design of honeybee and paper wasp nests derives from a common ancestor. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. Bob and Evan, you think this one is science. So you guys know what we're getting at here, right? It's the difference between homology and what's the other one?
Anti-homology.
Analogy. Homology
yes,
and
analogous
analogy.
And homologous.
Yes, homologous traits and analogous traits. Homologous traits are traits that are the same because they derive from a common ancestor. Analogous traits are traits that like look the same because they have the same function. Yes. So the question is, does the honeycomb design between honeybees and paper wasps, are they homologous or analogous? You know, did they evolve once and then they share them from that common ancestor? Or did they independently evolve the honeycomb design? Well, this one is the fiction.
Ooh,
good work,
job,
Jay.
Oh,
because they are analogous traits. They independently evolved the honeycomb design. And Jay, you're right when you say they look nothing like each other, because that's part of how we know homology versus analogy. If they're homologous, they should be similar in certain details, especially ones that are contingent and don't really necessarily reflect function, right? Like it'd be too much of a coincidence if they were the same in that particular detail, and it wouldn't be explained by function itself. But if they're just analogous, they'll be similar in ways that directly relate to function, but different in ways that don't by chance alone. So there's interesting differences between them. Now, the honeycomb design is really advantageous for a number of reasons. It is very strong. It's an extremely efficient use of material, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so evolution converged on this really efficient design, this hexagonal honeycomb design, even in these two lineages. What the paper that I'm pulling from was looking at was that was another very specific aspect. So both the honeybee nests and the paper wasp nests have another feature that's the same, and that is they have different size hexagonal segments for different purposes. Like they have one size for like the worker bees and another size for the eggs or whatever. And so they need to be able to connect the bigger hexagons with the smaller hexagons. And how do they do that? And they were just asking, do they do it? Did they find the same solution to that construction problem? And
it subcontracted out.
So they do it through intermediary non-hexagonal cells. Some of the differences. So here's a big difference. Tell me if you guys can imagine this. Honeybees build their honeycombs, right? They connect their hexagonal cells together vertically, mm-hmm. which means that the openings are to the side, right?
Right.
Paper wasps build them horizontally, which means that the openings are all from the bottom. And I know you guys know this because I know we have seen these nests together. They open up from the bottom, the cells, as opposed to from the sides, like with the honeybees. So anyway, they're independently evolved. They just evolution converged upon this maximally efficient design. Now, Jay, you said you wouldn't be surprised if honeybees and paper wasps have a common ancestor. First of all, everything has a common ancestor with everything else. It's only a matter of how far back you have to go. But honeybees and paper wasps are both Hymenoptera. They're both part of the same group of insects. They're both Hymenoptera. So they're actually fairly closely related, even though you go back 179 million years. But it also is a good reminder, you know, I was researching for this piece. We have a really fleshed out evolutionary tree of just the Hymenoptera with a lot of fossilized samples, mostly of fully
amber.
In amber, yeah, fully intact specimens in amber. We have transitional species between wasps and bees. You know what I mean?
Cool.
You zoom in on this one little group of animals, and there's like, yeah, we've got the evolution pretty worked out because they preserve well in amber, you know? So just an interesting side comment. All right, all of this means that researchers were able to transplant mitochondria into damaged kidney cells, improving energy production and reducing toxicity and physiological stress is science.
Give me deets.
Yeah, this is a great study. So, yeah, this is really, you know, a new model of transplanting mitochondria. And this could potentially be an entirely new form of medicine. It's called MITO, mitochondrial transplantation. And they did the study in two models of acute kidney injury. What they're looking for, one was in vivo, one was in vitro, or one was in vitro, one was ex vivo. They took it out of a living thing, not in vivo. What they were trying to simulate kidney transplant, right? Mm-hmm. You take a kidney out of a cadaverous donor. How do we keep that kidney alive long enough to transplant it into a recipient? And so what they were looking for was, well, if we transplant mitochondria into the kidney cells, would that keep it alive longer? Would that reduce the stress of the ischemia of the taking it from a corpse, you know? And they found that, yeah, they were looking at markers for it, but what they found was that in each of the model they transplanted mitochondria versus placebo, right? They just transplanted nothing just to go through the process. So the mitochondrial cells showed higher proliferative capacity, higher ATP production, and preservation of physiological polarization of the organelles, and lower toxicity, fewer reactive oxygen species. That's sort of the waste product of mitochondria, right? That's what you need antioxidants for, is to sort of sop up those reactive oxygen species that get cranked out by mitochondria. So basically, the cells did better. Now, this, you know, is just a basic science proof of concept. You know, we need to replicate this, as Evan points out, you know, in people, in actual, like, kidney transplants, for example. Mm-hmm. But also, this could be... You have implications, obviously, far beyond that.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. If you could make cells healthier, any diseased cells, make them function better, make them healthier by giving them some fresh, powerful mitochondria, then, of course, that gets you thinking, what if we could genetically engineer super mitochondria? You know?
Please, let's make this happen.
And that will, and their lifespans, what, turn into something superhuman?
Well, so let me just, I don't know, but let me just say this. So the efficiency of your mitochondria is really important to your longevity.
Exactly.
And, yeah, because mitochondria, like this is your basic metabolic function here. This is the thing that makes energy from calories, right?
ATP, man.
Yeah. And the more efficient your mitochondria are and the less stress they put on the cells, the less the fewer waste products they put out, the fewer reactive oxygen species they produce, the better. You know, the better, the less the stress on the cells, the longer they'll live, you know, they'll be.
Right. Animals that live longer is to a significant degree related to how efficiently, you know, how few waste products there are created and not ushered away and not because the waste products of metabolism in a lot of ways just they stay there, and that is implicated in a lot of aspects of aging.
And there are some disease states where basically you have malfunctioning mitochondria that are just cranking out toxic waste products, you know.
Jesus.
That's rough.
Yeah. So anyway, I'm all in favor of super mitochondria transplants. That could be
great.
That's
can't think of a downside other than cancer.
Totally feasible.
as long as the cancer doesn't occur or something.
Well, I mean, that's always a good point though, Evan, because you know there's a reason why we don't already have super mitochondria. You have to think, what is it? It could be that we just didn't get around to evolving it yet. You know, just chance. Or is it a trade-off? Is there a downside that we would also have to be able to compensate for? Maybe those super mitochondria would put stress on cells in a different way or increase the risk of cancer or whatever. You certainly don't want cancer cells with super mitochondria,
exactly.
Right?
Yes.
That would be a bad thing. So, you know, I hope that we could make it work and mitigate the downsides. That could be nothing we're going to benefit from, guys. Oh. But, I mean, this is like for future generations.
Oh, that's okay.
It's interesting to think about. This could be an interesting future medical technology. All right.
Oh, yeah, man.
Good job, Jay.
Thank you. Well done, Jay.
Evan, give us a quote.
Critical thinking is an active and ongoing process. It requires that we all think like Bayesians, updating our knowledge as new information comes in. And that was written by Daniel Levitin. His book, A Field Guide to Lies, Critical Thinking in the Information Age.
Very nice. And of course, we throw out the term like Bayesian analysis a lot, but it's really just that. It's just you have a prior probability, you get new information, you update the probability with the new information. That's a Bayesian thinking. But here's the thing, guys. Most people do that inherently for most things. People inherently take a Bayesian approach to what they believe. Where critical thinking comes in is in all the ways that we deviate from Bayesian analysis. And we deviate from a Bayesian approach anytime our emotions are engaged, there's something that we want to believe in, or our identity is being threatened, or we're defending our team, our tribe, right? So whenever we have a motivation to deviate from Bayesian analysis, we do. The critical thinking is in recognizing that consciously and conscientiously going back to a Bayesian approach, right?
Absolutely.
Because that's just a basic common sense approach. You know, new information, I'll update my belief to accommodate this new information. You don't throw out all the old information. You now just incorporate it into a new unified way of looking at things, right? You're not just jumping from belief to belief with each new piece of information. You're just adding it to the pile. You're adding it to the entire pile of information that you have, which makes perfect sense. And it's good to know that that's what we inherently do, unless we have a reason not to. Unfortunately, we have lots of reasons.
Lots of reasons. Then we're good at it.
What if you start with bad information and compound on that? I mean, isn't that a problem?
Well, yeah, but the thing is, though, the new information could be that your old information's bad. Right?
Oh, well, hopefully how it works.
It could replace it. You know, it could modify it. It could just add to it. It just depends on what on the context and what it is. You might learn that thing you thought was a fact was really wrong. It's like, oh, that's wrong? Okay, I'll update with the new thing that's true. Whatever.
Oh, Mark Twain didn't say that quote? Huh. Okay. Let's scratch that one.
It's so Mark Twain. All right. Thank you all for joining me this week.
You got it.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions. dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.